Okay, we're going to give our next presenter a couple minutes to get set up. I could do stand-up for you, but I'm told I'm not very funny, so. See, that was an attempt at a joke, and it didn't work.
Who's up next?
What?
I'm getting there. I'm buying him time. Okay, Martin Peck is going to be presenting Alpine. The Alpine Network, if I take my thumb off my notes, is a social discovery mechanism which can handle high churn rates, malicious peers, and limited bandwidth. See, now you've pressured me into doing the introduction, and he's not ready to go on. So,
all of you who want net access here and have wireless cards, thanks to Jim McCoy, we now have a hub operating, and you can get 802.11b in here. Thank you, Jim. And the name for it is CodeCon with capital C's. So that's functioning now.
Okay, my name is Martin Peck. I'll be presenting the Alpine Network. While this is setting up, I'll go ahead and tell you a little about this project. Alpine started back in 2000 during the heyday of the peer-to-peer hype. Currently, we had two big peer-to-peer networks, which were Gnutella and Napster, which were kind of at two ends of the extreme for locating content. Napster was a centralized searching architecture and proved to be very vulnerable and expensive. Gnutella, on the other hand, was fully decentralized, but due to the protocol, was very inefficient. And what I wanted to do was find some way to improve on that, which provided a decentralized architecture while retaining efficiency and efficient bandwidth usage. The main distinguishing feature of Alpine is the use of a UDP-based protocol and a social discovery mechanism. And what this provides is a lightweight messaging protocol, which allows a direct connection to all the peers you're communicating with, upwards of 10,000 or more peers. And the social discovery mechanism ensures that over time, the efficiency of your queries will improve. Peers that have similar content to what you're looking for will grow or will retain a higher relative quality in your peer lists, and in turn they will be queried more frequently. And over time you'll have a tuned group of peers that are very efficient for the specific types of resources you're looking for. I've also provided a set of CDs. Unfortunately, the software is fairly large due to the use of CORBA for the programmable interface. And this was proven a bit of cumbersome over dial-up links and so forth. So you can find the CDs over here if you'd like to grab a local copy of all the sources and binary builds, as well as a copy of the current website. The sources right now are about 8 meg to download. And compilation takes anywhere from a few hours on a fast system to half a day on something slow, unfortunately. So, the orb I'm using is the DAO orb. It's a set of software that's open source and basically consists of ACE, which is a communications layer that's portable across various operating systems from Unix to NT, as well as the DAO orb, which is built on top of that layer. That's something I've actually started on. I've wanted to add an XML RPC interface to that as well, and that should hopefully ease the, I guess, constraints on some systems where CORB is a bit heavyweight. It appears I have to leave the screen up for this to boot. I'm going to go ahead and start a presentation. Alpine covers a lot of ground, and as such, it tends to be fairly confusing. I prepared a short demo just to provide some background that will allow the demo to make a bit more sense. Okay, the official site is at cubicmetercrystal.com/alpine. This provides social discovery for peer networks. The five main points of Alpine are that it's fully decentralized, it adapts to user preferences, it also discourages freeloading while encouraging sharing. There's modular extensions for arbitrary metadata and additional transport support, and programmable interfaces for integration. Searching is critical to the value of a network. Most of the peer networks today, searching is implemented as kind of an afterthought. Their primary focus is either transferring files, providing some type of community network or something like that, where searching is required but not really the primary function. And as such, it tends to be the weakest point in these networks. Often these search implementations are hard to reuse. They're very specialized and coupled with the applications they've been included in. As I mentioned before, we've kind of had an evolution from two extremes. Napster was centralized, expensive and vulnerable. GNU/Telo is decentralized but inefficient with poor performance. The new hybrid networks such as FastTrack or GNU/Telo Reflectors impose a kind of limited hierarchy in these networks, and they're the current sweet spot. However, they still suffer from a number of common problems, including freeloaders. Sharing by default seems to help the problem, but there's still a lot of room for improvement. Forced methods such as upload-download ratios and agorics have been difficult to implement in a user-friendly manner. Network address translation, as mentioned yesterday, has been a real complicating factor. Dual NAT communication is nearly impossible in a TCP scenario. Relays are required. For single NAT, you have to have an intermediary peer to proxy these requests between the NAT and the un-NATed peer. Bootstrapping is also quite cumbersome. Right now, every new peer application has to receive a critical mass of peers before it actually becomes useful. This is Metcalfe's law in effect. Unfortunately, every single new application tends to go through this process. Obscure resources have a high search cost. If you're looking for something that's relatively unknown or obscure, you're going to have to spend a lot of time searching, and all the current implementations have no way to improve on the efficiency of obscure resources. Moving on to social discovery, Alpine has a number of features which are trying to counteract a lot of these faults. Freeloading is no longer such a problem in social discovery. Since all peer communication is direct and peer responses and performance are used to calculate a relative quality, freeloading peers will have a low relative quality and will quickly be dropped from various peer groups. Peers are encouraged to contribute, as this increases their relative quality, increases the quality of the peers they can remain connected to, and thus increases the capability of their search. It's adaptive. This is the social discovery mechanism that adapts to your preferences. If you're searching for obscure resources, you will slowly accumulate a group of peers which share similar interests in these obscure resources. And with a tuned peer group, you can quickly find obscure or unpopular resources quickly. I've designed the server to be flexible and extensible. All the modules actually implement the searching for various resources. The server itself simply provides a interface between modules which interface with actual resources, whether they be files or documents, and performs the queries over the network. All the modules are actually responsible for indexing resources and transferring data. There are distinct groups of peers that are provided. For example, you may have a music peer group for searching for music. You may have a document group for searching for various technical documents. And in short, this should provide an effective solution to the resource discovery problem in large peer networks. Now on to the demo. What I'm going to do first is start up a set of three different servers that will act as the peers that the demo server is going to interact with. These three peers have been configured for three distinct types of resources. The first peer will be a source file peer that has a number of source files indexed. The second peer is a document peer, which will locate various HTML documents, and the third is a music peer, which can locate various music files. Okay, what this is doing first for these test servers, essentially I have to first load a module, which is the generic file sharing module. The Alpine server itself does nothing on its own. Everything's really accomplished through the modules, which provide access to the files, as well as actually retrieve content using various locators. Ideally, this was intended to tie into other networks where data transferred is more their specialty, such as Swarmcast or BitTorrent. The first step is starting the server. You'll notice that all the server and client scripts are all the server and client commands are actually scripts. The reason for this is there's a number of command line parameters for specifying naming service, IORs, various IP and port. And so these are just a quick wrapper to kind of allow a separation between the runtime configuration and the actual commands. First thing we're going to do is register the module. And you'll notice that we received a module ID. We loaded the module, configured the module, and this is a dump of the module configuration. This includes a short description provided by the module author, the shared library path to the module, a bootstrap symbol, and an active time. And now we're going to connect to the three different test servers I have running. Okay. The show DTCP connections actually dumps the low-level connection that is present between these peers. This is the UDP-based protocol, which now allows for a short messaging transport between peers. These connections are persistent, and when the server is shut down, a deactivate connection command is sent to these various peers. When the server restarts, these connections are reactivated. Basically, the social discovery mechanism requires that a connection between peers be much longer lived than a traditional TCP connection. This is so that profile information can be persisted between IP address and port changes, server runtime, and so forth. What I've done here is now create a set of different groups for searching for the three different types of resources I'm going to demo. We've got a music group. We've got a music group, a HTML group, and a sources group. The show peer group info will display the number of peers and the group information for every group. Music group first, we see we have peer ID 1, 2, and 0. Okay, we've got a number of groups here, HTML group, which lists the peers within that group, a sources group, and finally a default group. You'll notice that all the statistics are zero since I've done nothing with these peers at this point. Now I'm going to start three queries using the three different groups. Started a query for CPP with the sources group, a query for HTML with the HTML group, and a query for MP3 with the MP3 group. The number of results returned is configurable either in the modules themselves or at the peers. I have this limited to 128, although I actually have far fewer files indexed, so the results will be fewer. Results include the peer ID where these results were obtained, a name of the resource, which in this case is a source file, the size, a description, which implies that this was created by a generic file module share specification, which I will talk about later, and two sets of locators. The way the module is created right now is that all content is indexed by SHA hash, and two sets of locators are returned. One is more of a universal resource identifier, which is basically just the SHA hash of the resource. The second is an actual locator, which includes the IP address and port where this can be obtained. The reason this was done is so that a given resource, once located, can remain in cache, so to speak, so that when transferred, it can use the most recent set of locators. If you're trying to download something and it's no longer available using locators in your cache, you can simply re-query, obtain a fresh set of locators, and know that you're getting the same file you'd found earlier. If we check the peer groups now, we see that for the music peer group, we have a relative quality of 2 since it responded to a query. And unfortunately, I've got a bug in the code. I thought I had this updated. Queries aren't actually incremented. You should see a 1 in all the query fields since I've added a 1, or I've started 1 query for each. As you can see, the relative quality is increased for each of the associated peers with the associated resources in those groups. To actually download files, you can create what's called a store specification, and this simply tells the server where these files are going to be downloaded. In this case, I'm going to create one in /tmp/files. I've obtained a And what this does is it basically allows you to set constraints on the maximum number of files that will be stored in this directory, the maximum number of bytes, and so forth. This also allows you to direct different resources into different locations. For example, if you're downloading sources, you may want that to go to a different directory than if you're downloading MP3 files. Once you've created a store specification, you can request a resource, which simply accepts a locator as well as the destination store specification. You can see that I use the identifier style resource locator, and what this will do is it'll actually translate that into the most recent locator with IP and port where I can actually obtain that resource. We can see that the resource request completed. We've got all the bytes, and if we check the directory, we'll see the file there. There's also a shortcut if you know you want to download all the files for a given query. You can specify the query ID and the store specification, and it will request all of those files. To demo the connection persistence, I'm going to shut down the server and restart it. And what happens when the server shut down is that there's a packet sent to all the peers it's connected to, which says that I'm terminating. And that sets the connection state of those remote peers to deactive or idle. And at that point, these peers will periodically try to reactivate that connection or wait until the server comes back online. And showing the current connections, again, we can see that all 3 peers are back and reconnected. Now to go into a bit more detail about the generic file interface, this also as well provides a CORBA interface for the various operations it provides. If I list the resource hashes, what this does is basically a list of all the resources that were located in the various queries. These are all SHA hashes. And each of these act as a key for the various sets of locators where these resources can be found. We can see if we list the resource locations that there's 2 sets of locators here for that file. Again, all files that are downloaded are shared by default. Everything's assigned an ID. All this information is persisted, so most of the time you'll see any kind of object identified by a 4-byte unsigned integer. And that concludes this demo. Move on to questions. Anybody have any questions?
Just a really quick question. If it's UDP based, and it's
Well, that's a good question. Basically,
the question was, is it UDP based for those who couldn't hear? And what about if it doesn't arrive?
Using UDP was probably the biggest challenge of this project. As UDP is unreliable, and so there's certain things which have to be reliable within this protocol. Certain things such as resource requests, the package you mentioned, the deactivate connections, all of those are reliable. However, there are some that are unreliable. For example, query discover is sent to a large number of peers. Anything that's sent to more than one peer is unreliable by default. So unreliable connections, we just assume the best. Reliable connections, if that packet were to get lost, it would be resent with a back-off interval. If that failed, the remote peer would essentially time out that connection after a given number of reliable connections back to that peer failed. So ideally, that deactivate connection request would be received. If it isn't, then the other peer would simply time out that connection after a given period of time.
Quick follow-up. Why is it then advantageous to actually send the deactivate message instead of letting it time out?
Well, the reason for that is that you may, basically, the way the profiling works, anytime there is a bad event, such as a timeout, a bad packet's received, that reduces the quality of that peer. So if you do not send the deactivate request, you're going to have a number of queries come in, I think it's set to about three, that will all time out because those are reliable requests. I'm sorry, not queries, but like pings or peer discovers. And if that occurs, then your relative quality will slowly drop by a number of three ticks or so before your connection's actually deactivated. So that's an attempt to keep your relative quality high, although it's not actually required.
It strikes me that once you have your gen file locator, that gen file locator is valid for an arbitrary length of time and no matter who returns the value. So when you do a query and you discover a file that has a gen file locator, do you cache that for and return that yourself when somebody queries?
I don't actually. That's one thing I want to implement for integration with other networks. Right now there is no mechanism for searching locally. There's definitely a distinction between what's found remotely, which is the generic file locators and the SHA hashes for those resources, and also what is present locally on your system. Right now, it'd be a very simple tweak, and I simply haven't done it, to first search locally for anything that matches your query, and then search remotely if that's not enough.
What algorithm are you actually using to determine if peers? You said before that, you know, over time it would actually learn socially which peers are identical. What algorithm are you using for that?
That's a pretty simple, it's basically a beta curve selection, kind of like a fuzzy selection based on a single set. It's just a weighted probability. Peers with higher relative qualities will be selected more often than peers with a lower relative quality. And it's weighted so that on occasion, you will get a low-quality peer that you try because they may be new. They may actually be good, and you don't know it yet. But the vast majority of time, you'll actually be using the known high-quality peers. The values that affect the relative peer quality itself are, there's basically two kinds. There's implicit, which is basically the protocol conformance. If you get a bad packet from a peer or they're not behaving correctly, that reduces their quality. If they respond to queries and provide resources, that increases their relative quality. And also, the more often they're available, basically the longer they're online and so forth, increases their quality. There's also explicit feedback. Let's say you downloaded a resource and it's not what it appeared to be. You can actually decrement the quality for that peer explicitly using the interface.
Is there more documentation on this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there is. It's online. If you check the FAQ as well as the, I believe it's mostly in the FAQ and also the overview.
Okay.
So So you've addressed a lot of questions of dealing with freeloaders and stuff, and you haven't really looked at the opposite side of people misusing the system. What about people who want to get on and put their stuff up and drown everyone else out, the spammers of the Alpine network? What have you thought about for how to deal with that?
Right. That was a big concern, is basically the vulnerability of the network. One thing I saw with Nutella was that it took a very little amount of effort to broadcast a number of packets out there, and it just multiplied based on the protocol itself, which could make a really efficient denial of service. You also have like the hybrid networks where you're actually relying on peers submitting valid data. If they don't, then you're really out of luck. So what Alpine has done is basically made a one-to-one relationship for all communication. Someone who starts spamming you with packets or that kind of thing will actually get dropped fairly quickly. Their relative quality will be just about zero. If they're actually flooding, then they're immediately blacklisted. There's some metrics there for like a maximum amount of bandwidth and that kind of thing. As well as, let's say if they respond with bogus results, that also impacts their quality. And they will shortly be dropped from your peer groups.
So it sounds like a high-quality peer is going to be using more of its bandwidth serving requests. Do you have any incentives for a peer to become a high-quality peer?
The incentive for high-quality peers to remain so is that the peers they connect to will also be high-quality. The peers they connect to that are low-quality will basically be using their bandwidth with no payback, so to speak, and they'll quickly be dropped from that group to keep the bandwidth at the desired levels.
So you talked about one of your goals in the beginning being to kind of be efficient and allow peer groups to form that kind of have data together which is obscure. Do you know if that works? Have you tried it on a semi-large scale? I mean, your demo showed that the files can go back and forth, but how big does it work?
Yeah, that's really an unknown question right now. How well this works and how long it takes to optimize a peer group, how well you can find obscure resources, there's a lot of factors that tie into that, not only the number of peers, but also whether the resources are actually out there that you're looking for and so forth. So right now that is a big unknown. The network hasn't scaled to the size where you could actually test that in a real world fashion.
I've got a question about how long it takes to build up a set of peers that would be, I don't know, more like the stuff that you're interested in. Have you done testing like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. That basically ties into peer discovery. And with Alpine, you have basically two steps. There's the initial peer discovery, which I showed, which was the add peer command. And that's kind of the first bootstrap step you have to take. I've thought about tying this in with downloading a known page which has a list of known peer IDs, kind of like the host caches and so forth. However, right now I've kept it manual in that you have to know who you want to start with. Once you have at least one peer that you're connected to, that kicks off what's called like a transitive introduction phase, where you periodically ask that peer for the peers it's connected to.
I was just going to suggest that, like second level of indirection.
And in fact, the way that works as well is that you start with the high quality peers and ask them who they're connected to, which have a more, a higher likelihood of knowing peers that you're interested in as well. So that peer discovery operates on a group by group basis using the high quality peers within those groups.
Okay.
So the one thing that seems to be slightly worrying about what you developed is by requiring like this high quality peers only be willing to talk to other high quality peers, you really only allow yourself to have people sort of trade sort of services in kind. And it really means people who either can't be a high quality peer or who really just want to be consumers are sort of cut out of your network. So either by economic or just desire, they might not be able to play.
Well, the key to remember is that all this is configurable by the person themselves, the node operator. By default, if you've got tight bandwidth constraints and tight memory constraints, and you can only hold X number of peers, you're going to have a lot less leeway for, I guess, the lower quality peers. Someone that has a lot more bandwidth, a lot more memory, they may not mind and don't mind keeping 50,000 connections open. They can retain a number of low quality peers without any, without any problem. So it really depends on how you have your node configured, as far as which quantity or which ratio of high to low quality peers you have.
I guess something that I sort of, there's sort of two questions there, and the other one is whether you see any way of adding some kind of sort of exchange of value that's not just an in kind kind of change. One of the original ideas of Mojonation was you could put in money eventually, maybe through the tokens if you weren't providing services.
Right, yeah, that'd be a great idea. The only thing I've thought about close to that is that high power node operators, for example, can issue or can create what they call a proxy connection, where a single peer can have them proxy requests and whatnot so forth for them. So you may have a low quality peer, and through some real world interaction, maybe this is a friend of yours or so forth, he allows you to use his high powered node to basically perform much, much better queries, even though you can actually be a high quality peer yourself.
Questions?
Anything else? One more thing I guess I'll talk about. I'm surprised this didn't come up. One of the other real hard parts of using UDP protocols is congestion control. And the way Alpine implements congestion control is a bit different than what you'd find in a bearer transport like TCP. Right now the stack is configured with basically limits on the bandwidth. You might assign it maybe 10% of your bandwidth or 20%. And what it does is the outgoing sending is throttled for that rate, so there's no problem with outgoing congestion. Incoming is a bit difficult, and what happens is the stack keeps track of how much data is incoming. The moment it starts going over that threshold, it starts culling peer groups to reduce the amount of incoming bandwidth. And that takes the lowest quality peers and closes their connections until the incoming bandwidth is back within the thresholds. And so that's really where the peer group culling comes into play when you start deactivating connections of the low-quality peers to keep bandwidth within constraints.
What's the basis for node identity within the network?
Node identity is really the only thing that identifies a node is simply your connection to them. There's no correlation between what I view one peer's ID and what I view another's. It's simply a random number that's assigned that's unique for that connection. And that connection is persisted for as long as possible. The deactivate and reactivate part of the protocol allows you to shut down a node and then resume connections later, and so forth.
Does that mean you're susceptible to people stealing identities?
Well, basically what's included in reactivation is there's a unique ID that's assigned to each peer. It's not truly unique. It's simply a 4-byte integer. And you assign one peer their peer ID that they have to use when they're talking to you, and vice versa. So that prevents spoofing of packets between peers. The deactivation basically requires the peer to provide their previous IP and port plus the previous ID that you provided them. So it's fairly difficult to spoof. You would actually have to have some kind of network sniffer in place at one end that can actually monitor all this traffic and track those IDs.
With regards to how you generate your quality metric, if you put up a server and don't do many searches, it strikes me that you'll have a very interestingly skewed quality metric. And if you base quality of another server on the basis of how many searches they send you, you'll essentially end up with a peer group of a bunch of servers that don't ever query each other.
Actually, I should clarify that a bit. Quality metrics only done from your end. The number of times that a peer queries you really doesn't affect your quality unless they're querying too much and causing, using up way too much bandwidth or so forth. So in that scenario, what you'd get with is all your peer groups would simply have a flat peer quality. And they would remain so until you started actually performing some queries that provided the input needed to judge the relative quality of the peers.
Any more questions? Anyone?
Time for a break. Thank you very much.